Big three grocery chains say that's unlikely. They blame the union for delays and call the deadline arbitrary. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Deborah Baer reports.
Bob Mitchell is a produce man at Vaughn's in Pasadena. He's been with the company for 33 years. During his union's last strike 3 years ago, he lost $12,000 plus wages, but he says he's ready to do it again.
There's a lot of anger and resentment towards the companies because these out-of-town corporations seem to be focused only on greed and their bonuses and their stockholders. So we don't want to, but we will.
The United Food and Commercial Workers Union locals are demanding better health care benefits for new employees with shorter waiting periods for eligibility. And they want raises. New workers and their families now wait 1 to 2.5 years to qualify for benefits. Adina Tesler, a spokeswoman for the supermarket chains, says there has been progress.
There is currently a health care proposal on the table that is a dramatically better health care proposal than what currently exists.
But the two sides are still far apart on how to fund it. The negotiations are being closely monitored by unions in Northern and Central California. Their contracts expire later this year. The strike in 2003 lasted nearly 5 months. It cost the grocery chains billions of dollars and some workers their homes. The supermarkets say they're willing to talk about raises if bargaining continues. But Barbara Maynard, with the largest UFCW local, says they've dragged on long enough.
There is no reason that they need any more time to put together a comprehensive proposal.
Maynard says this Sunday, workers will vote on whatever proposal is on the table today. If they reject it, a walkout could begin as early as next week. For the California Report, I'm Deborah Baer in Los Angeles.
Most of California's largest cities have some kind of independent body to consider complaints about the police department, but not Fresno. In the wake of several high-profile lawsuits there, critics are now clamoring for an independent police auditor. Fresno's mayor has joined the call by including money for an auditor in his proposed city budget. But as Sasha Coker reports, he faces stiff opposition from the city council as it prepares to take a final vote on that budget today.
The city of Fresno has settled 18 claims involving the police department over the last 6 years. The largest settlement stemmed from an incident in the spring of 2005. Gabriel and Rebecca Rodriguez were at a party celebrating the return of an American soldier from Iraq. Police arrived on the scene, responding to a disturbance call. The Rodriguez's attorney, Ken Brakebill, explains what happened next.
This officer approached Gabriel Rodriguez and began striking him with his baton. Gabriel's head bust open, blood began to gush out. Gabriel fell to the ground. His wife, Rebecca, leaned down and covered herself over her husband to try to protect him. But the particular officer continued to hit Gabriel with his baton and also repeatedly struck Rebecca.
The police then arrested the couple and charged them with battery of an officer and resisting arrest. The Rodriguezes filed a complaint with the city, but city officials determined the Fresno Police Department had acted properly. The couple brought their case to federal court, and the city agreed to settle for $1.6 million. The court entered a judgment in favor of all of the Rodriguezes' claims, including that their injuries were part of an unconstitutional pattern of arresting people, using excessive force and without probable cause. Ken Brakebill.
There was what we call deliberate indifference, an atmosphere of tolerance within the city of Fresno and Fresno Police Department that created the opening, the opportunity for this particular officer on the night in question to use his baton in an untoward way against our clients.
Critics point to the Rodriguez case as an example of the failure of the police department to keep officers in check. The department does have an internal complaint process, but in February, a Fresno County grand jury report found those internal police review procedures were inadequate and recommended the establishment of an independent police auditor. Mayor Alan Autry agrees with that recommendation, even though he's a staunch defender of the police department.
I think we have the finest police force in the country. Having said that, I also understand that maintaining of community trust is essential to a successful police force. We should have nothing to fear from an impartial third party without an axe to grind to look at any and all issues in the police department.
I'm not sure why the mayor keeps proposing this. Our police department is in no way, shape, or form out of control.
That's City Council member Brian Calhoun. The council has voted down the mayor's request for an auditor 3 times already. The Fresno Police Department hasn't taken an official stand on the question of an auditor, but the Fresno Police Officers Association is firmly against it. President Jackie Park says he's all for accountability, but a police auditor isn't the solution. He says fear of an auditor's judgment may make some officers question themselves on the job.
It could cost him his or her life. It could cost the life of a member of our community because they're second-guessing themselves. They're not just relying on their instinct and their training to get through the incident.
In a preliminary vote this week, the Fresno City Council moved to delete the money for a police auditor position from the budget. The council will take a final vote on that city budget today. If money for a police auditor doesn't make it through this time, Mayor Alan Autry will have one more opportunity to introduce it during his final year in office. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
That's the California Report for Thursday, June 21st, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. AARP and its more than 3 million California members working to ensure access to affordable, quality health care for all Californians. Online at aarp.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.
The preceding portion of the California Report in the evening news was brought to you by Camille Parsons Presents. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. It's 7 o'clock and time for Education Now. Education Now is being brought to you tonight by the Mendocino Community Network and our members, of course. The Mendocino Community Network is a high-speed internet access and web hosting nationwide with DSL service in parts of Mendocino, Fort Bragg, Ukiah, and throughout California. Information at dsl.mcn.org, and we thank Mendocino Community Network very much. And, of course, you are members. We're coming up time for Education Now, so I'm going to give you some music and then on with our guest, Christopher Melville. Hold on. Here comes the music.
Well, I think it's fine. Building jumbo planes or taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want if you want, 'cause you can get anything. I know we've come a long way. We're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play? Hey, 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 hey. Hey, hey. Will you roll on roads over fresh green grass for your lorry load? Oh. Pumping petrol, gas, and you make them long, and you make them tough, but they just go on and on, and it seems that you can't get off. No, I know we've come a long way.
we're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play?
Well, welcome to Education Now. Tonight we're going to be talking about violence and with Christopher Melville. Christopher is one of the producers of Education Now. He's on the board of Hermeneutics Institute for Holistic Health and Education, which produces our show. He's also my webmaster and consultant, and it's really great to have him here with us tonight. I want to thank Molly for sharing him with us, and I know that, you know, he's a very busy person. Christopher graduated from Melville Montessori School in 1995. He had enough advanced placement credit from Mendocino College to be exempt from most GE or general education requirements, as well as playing soccer and being a referee. And teaching at Melville Montessori School honors English, dance, and fine arts. He won a scholarship for speeches in the county competition for his speech, Today's Youth, Why the Violence and the Media, Do They Go Too Far? He danced with Kaleidoscope Dance Company, which had a review in San Francisco, and was teaching at Sonoma State from his first semester. He continued to teach at Melville Montessori School during his college years and had been a part of award-winning performances in mock trial during his high school years. He's been a part of a producing band, a singing leads and playing the trumpet. He graduated with a BA in dance and a BA in English from Sonoma State University. After he graduated, he began work in a Montessori preschool. He completed his AMS training for Montessori teachers, and he continued his education in early childhood in St. Helena. As an extension of his research and work in youth violence in the arts, he was asked to give workshops to teachers on integrating the expressive arts into the curriculum at the AMS Fall Conference in 1995. A further extension of his passion in this project is FanWar, which he developed, and you can check that out at fanwar.com on the web. Chris will go into FanWar tonight, and he'll give us some contact information about his project as well. Today, Christopher is living with his wife, Molly, in Mendocino County and teaching at the Tree of Life Montessori Charter School, as well as working on another teaching credential. So welcome, Christopher.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And so let's start right out, Chris, with the first question. Why are children today so violent? Are they more violent than they used to be?
Well, violence is really a major issue in the culture today, and particularly children's violence. I want to focus on that. It's really pervasive, and it's a constant, and it's overwhelming in our youth today. It's something we need to really take a closer look at. I'd like to begin an experiment. There was an experiment done with children and violence, and I think it shed some light on how complex this issue is. So there's a study involving a group of normally passive preschoolers, and their aggressiveness triples after watching this TV program. And so if you take that study at face value, you might easily conclude that violent media is the source of youth violence today. But when you put the study in context, things start to look different. So, you know, can you guess what the program was that these kids were watching?
Well, I know, so why don't you go ahead and tell our
listeners? Okay, well, you know, you just usually assume it'd be like Pokemon or Power Rangers, something with violent content. Well, it wasn't, though. It's actually Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers. So these are like two shows that are actually designed to promote pro-social behavior. And the study kind of serves to make a point that violence is not as simple as a statistic or an experiment in a lab. You really have to take into account the complexity of the human being. Bernard Friedlander of the University of Hartford has a great quote on this. And he says, "To understand the development of aggression, one must examine simultaneously a multiplicity of interrelated social, cultural, familial, and cognitive factors. And each of those adds only a small increment to the totality of the causality. And it's unrealistic to expect that any one of these factors by itself can explain much about aggression. But in conjunction with each other, they explain a lot about aggression. All of those things are interrelating. The complexity of the human being." And so I kind of want to explore that, how complex violence is. I mean, it's really not disputed that youth violence is a major issue. I mean, I've had that discussion with people before, you know, is youth violence a major issue? And in the past, you know, in the 90s, it was more of an issue of, is it really an issue? But the statistics bear it out. I mean, it's incredible when it comes to the statistics of youth violence. I mean, from 1985 to 1983, murders committed by people over the age of 25, you know, dropped 20%, but they increased 65% among 18 to 24-year-olds and increased 165% among 14 to 17-year-olds. And this is, it's a very pervasive effect, although it is a very much a United States effect. I mean, in 1992, handguns killed like 33 people in Britain. Like 39 people in Sweden, 97 people in Switzerland, and 13,200 people in the United States. Mm. So it's very much a United States children violence issue.
An American thing.
It is an American thing. And so that helps you to kind of put it in perspective as well, that children and violence and this being connected to American children and violence. And how do we understand that?
Well, then does that lead to our next question, which is how do we as teachers and adults deal with this violence?
Well, it does kind of. I mean, we have to understand where it's coming from. Violence doesn't emerge in a vacuum. David Mantell said that violence has to have a source. And so to understand that, you have to kind of find that source. Where is the violence coming from? Because if you don't know where it's really coming from, then how do you expect to kind of understand it? And I already mentioned the theory of media violence, which it's not exactly a theory, but it's a bit too simplistic. There's the TV and violent video game argument that's what causes all this violence, and that's a seemingly logical theory, but it doesn't really bear it out. There's another theory that there's the biological or the genetic theory, which is sometimes referred to as the bad seed theory. You know that there are these children that are predisposed to violence and due to like high testosterone levels or various other chemical imbalances, and that has a seemingly logical theory, but both are really critically flawed. And I can explain about that. Like the first, the media violence theory falls into the category of behavioral psychology, you know, that postulated by social learning theory, right? That it, you know, this is Albert Bandura in the 60s, you know, like that. Well, but Judith Levin kind of...
What was his name?
Albert Bandura. Uh-huh. In the 60s, he's a sort of behavioral psychologist, and that comes out of Skinner too. He was sort of he was trained under Skinner, right. And so Judith Levin kind of debunks that myth, and she has a book called "Shooting the Messenger."
Judith Levin,
yeah. And here I have a quote from her, which is, "It's an oversimplified interpretation of social learning theory, has trickled down through the ranks of research psychologists to the NewsHour talking heads and to frighten parents." And it's like monkey see, monkey do, you know. But she warns that, you know, quote, like a big piece of social learning theory is left out of this, you know, and that's the interpretation. The larger world of relationships and meanings in which the child views the show associates the images with things that he knows and feels and how he behaves. And then when the picture is turned off, you know, what changes? So that's the context. And that social learning theory is much more complex than people make it out to be. They're like, oh, he saw violence, now he does violence. That's social learning. That isn't social learning. Social learning is much more complicated. Another thing that kind of debunks that whole social learning theory is a book by Gerard Jones. The book's called Killing Monsters, Why Children Need Fantasy, Superheroes, and Make-Believe Violence.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, most statistical laboratory conducted research, Gerard says, links violent behavior to violent images and wrongly implies a simplistic kind of cause-effect relationship, when the reality is as complex as the emotional lives of each individual child who views those images. That's a quote from Gerard Jones. And so the whole idea of social learning theory that kids are learning to be socially violent from watching this media stuff is oversimplistic. I'm not going to say it doesn't have an effect, because actually when I'm talking a bit later about social learning theory and our concerns about social learning, social learning, there is an effect there, but it isn't the whole piece. And that's the important part to get from that it's much more complicated than that. And, you know, there's also that whole biological idea does it come from biological sources? Are kids just predisposed to be violent? Well, You know, one great answer to that question
that's
is...
That would be the bad seed thing.
Yes, the bad seed theory. Well, this is a great answer to that one. Gee, why did all these, like, percentages jump in the last 20 years? Oh, I guess we got a lot more kids who are predisposed to violence just being born, you know, randomly. And then you could go into all sorts of technological reasons why. Oh, maybe there's something in our, you know, in our culture that's our technology that's creating genetics.
Well, we know there's something in the food.
Oh, yeah, it got to be.
All that sugar.
Got to be that, you know. Well, there, let me give you some evidence. Let's give you some facts. Okay, so you know, on the biological chemical factors, like such as testosterone being the source of violence, okay, if you examine, this is January 2003 Science News, right? There's an article called Testosterone's Family Ties.
Yeah.
And so the study investigates the effects of high testosterone levels in children, and it found that, quote, the behavior and mood problems traditionally blamed on testosterone most often appear in boys and girls with poor parental relations.
Oh.
So in fact, the children with the highest testosterone levels were less aggressive and violent than children with low testosterone levels who had a positive relationship with their mother. So if people had a positive relationship with their mother, and they could have through the roof testosterone levels, it didn't matter. They were mellow.
You're
they
going
were
off
cool.
My charts here on this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
So, you know, so this kind of points you into the direction of what's really more at the heart of this violence thing, which is a more plausible kind of source for the violence, which is it was closer to home. It's sort of the deterioration and breakdown of the family, and I use that term loosely, family, because you know, a functional family is not the average family. There's a statistics, you know, what's an average family? Well, average family is, you know, mom and a dad and 2.5 kids. I don't know how you have 2.5 kids, but hey, you know, yeah. That's the average, right? So. That's for average, but really that's not a functional family. A functional family is a family that has love, that has compassion, that has dialogue, that where kids talk, where parents talk to the kids talk to the parents. Nothing to do with blood relations. It's everything to do with whether there is functional communication.
So nothing to do with blood relations.
Mm-hmm. And when you have that sort of functional family where the primary caregivers interact with one another,
yes,
and they interact with the kids, and there's a loving communication there, then you get a really good relationship. And that's likely, there's, you know, Jung has a quote about that too, that Carl Jung has a quote that, you know, children are so involved in the psychological attitudes of their parents that it's no wonder that most of the nervous disorders in childhood could be traced to a disturbed psychic atmosphere in the home. And that's an example of where that when the breakdown of the family happens, that children immediately feel it. And I think we kind of shy away from that.
I think
source.
I've seen that quote before in Francis Wick's The Secret World of Childhood.
Yeah, Frances Wicks is another great authority on that. She has some great examples of how when a child's wealth of feeling is ignored or not desired, then they develop a sense of impotence and inferiority, which may find vent in rage or acts of cruelty. So you have this sense of kids not really being loved. But that not being loved also comes from not being appreciated or not being allowed to express. That's a really key factor. When kids are
not being allowed to express.
Okay. And there's lots of examples of where you have a functional family and you'll have kids who they consume a certain amount of violent media, they consume a certain amount of violent video games, and they don't really become violent because they have this ability to express and to communicate with their parents about what they're dealing with.
So they don't feel alone.
Yeah, well, they have a way to communicate with each other. Mm. And, you know, so really that's a key piece here. That's a really key thing I want to get at, is that you need to have a family that can understand and a family you can talk to. And
so when we're saying, how do we as teachers and adults deal with this violence?
Well, how do we deal with it happens to do with whether or not we allow kids to express themselves.
Aha.
Or whether we ban war play and we ban that activity. We say that activity's bad, you don't do it. Now, once again, this is also kind of a simplistic idea, okay? You have to understand that kids need to be expressive. You have to have an understanding that play is how kids learn. This is Piagetian philosophy. Kids learn and they understand through play. If you don't allow kids to play, then they don't process things. So understanding this philosophy, you go, well, if I ban kids from playing out violence, well, then I'm actually damaging their ability to process it, deal with it, and you know, be okay with it, and then go move on, right? Usually when you ban something, it becomes a taboo.
Right.
And many teachers, especially early childhood teachers, will say, well, you know, I banned war play at my school, but then they just do it behind the slide, you know, where I can't see them. And they're over there playing guns, and then, you know, I can't be involved in it. And there's a really great book on this, which is called The War Play Dilemma. And it's by Diane Elevin and Nancy Carlson Page. And it really breaks apart the war play dilemma and explains that this dilemma isn't really a dilemma. We say that, well, in order to solve the violence in our youth today, we need to do one of two things. We either need to let kids play out their violence, you know, let them be really violent and let them play out their violence and just not do anything about it, or we need to ban it and keep them from doing it because that's what's causing them to be violent. But that's a false dichotomy, that you need to do one of those two things. That really what you need to do is something in between. And what Diane Elevin and Nancy Carlson Page talk about in the book is that you really, the best thing to do is to get in there with the kids and actively facilitate the war play with them. You know, get into that gun play or that violent play that they're doing. Be in there with them, you know, and actively facilitate it. Play it with them. Because when you're in there playing with the kids, then they get to play, and that play is helping them process what they're learning. That's how children learn. If they don't play it, they don't process it. And so you have to get in there and play with them. And as teachers, often that's difficult. That's hard to do. A lot of teachers don't feel comfortable doing war play. You know, they don't feel comfortable getting in there.
And a lot of parents don't either, right?
Yeah,
isn't that what she says in the book? Even?
Yeah, parents and teachers don't feel comfortable doing it. So they give you a second option there in the book, which is to limit war play, but to also allow it with parameters.
And redirect.
Yeah, parameters are important. Michael Gurian's a great author on, he has a book called The Wonder of Boys.
Uh-huh.
And he talks a lot about how boys are a major factor in this whole violence thing. I mean, really, I mean, we might say that we have a violence problem, but we really have a very American boy violent problem, because, I mean, we have a slight increase in crimes by women, but you could say that, you know, really 90% of murderers are men. And almost every study linking media consumption with increased aggression sees these effects in boys far more than girls. So if effects in girls are observed at all. So Michael Gurian has a book called The Wonder of Boys, and he talks about...
Yeah, we heard him on KZYX once.
Excellent. Excellent. And he gives this whole point that when boys are not raised correctly, so we're back to the functional family again, right?
Right?
When the boys aren't raised correctly, they don't tend as much to, like, turn on girls, which is what girls will do. They'll turn on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But boys will turn... They'll act out on the society. Rather than themselves. So even though girls are being affected by this not being raised effectively, you don't see it as violence. You see it as them turning on themselves. But boys, they express it out. So how do you solve that? How do you deal with this? How do you help kids process this? Because Michael also talks about that there are sort of three levels of a family. There's the nuclear family, which is really just what I talked about before. But there's also the sort of larger ring of the social or the cultural family. And the school's part of that. And so as a teacher, you have to look for ways of, you're part of the child's social family. And you have to be modeling for them, how do we deal with violence? And do you really want to be modeling that a sort of ban about violence? Or do you want to be modeling that they need to express themselves, they need to process this stuff and get through it? And if you choose to ban it, I mean, you really want to think about that. If you choose to ban that violent behavior, you've just taken yourself out of their process. Mm-hmm. You've just taken away one of the really great influences on their life, mm-hmm. you as a teacher. And you could really be in there helping them to solve this stuff they're going through.
Well, you know, when you were a child, I'm a person of the 60s. And in the 60s, of course, this was the main thing. No war toys, you know, peace, that was the way. And even though I am a very 60s person, I didn't agree with that. I agreed with Joseph Campbell, who and Jung, you know, that what we're doing is we're acting out the whole of history, you know, in the collective unconscious. And so kids are acting these things out, and it's beneficial for them. to do that, and it's in play, right? And that if you repress it, then you're going to get acting out.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. There's examples I've seen as a teacher, and then also in the book as well, of children who they go and watch a scary movie, you know, something that had, like, you know, Godzilla or something that has some kind of violence in it. And usually you'll see young children, you know, I'm talking about early childhood, 4 or 5 year olds, you know, they see something scary. What do? Well, they go act it out. They go get their toys and they'll act it out. They'll do it. And a lot of times people will like, they shouldn't be doing that. That's bad. They're going to learn to be violent. But if you wait, or if you get in there and kind of like play it with them, but you don't try to change it right away, right? You just sort of play with them with it. What you find is that the child processes it, and then they start coming up with these other solutions. And that helps them deal with the fear that they're feeling. But if you ban it, that fear sort of gets locked. Right. And then it explodes later because they haven't processed it.
Yes, yes.
So that's something that I think is really critical, is helping children to express that violence. And that's what's so sad about this whole dilemma, is that we have a plethora of violent media and violent video games that are just, I mean, really affecting kids. I mean, they do have an effect. And then what do we do about it? What do we do about all this violent media that kids are being subjected to? Oh, we ban violent activity. Great. So basically, you're putting tons of violent imagery into me,
right,
but you're not providing me with any means.
They're absorbing it, but
let it go.
Right.
So you have this real problem of this bottling effect of kids just being fed violent stuff and then not being able to let it out.
Right. Not being able to let it out. And I think, is that sort of what led you to FANWAR?
Yeah, well, FANWAR, I should explain a little bit more. FANWAR is the short term for fantasy warplay, which is a live-action role-play. A live-action role-play is a game in which kids get together and they act out. There's a lot of drama involved. And we also have weapons. We have little swords or shields, foam padded stuff. And these games exist all over the world. There are LARPs all over the world. And
what did you call them?
LARPs, a LARP, L-A-R-P. And they go by different names, Society
and
for Creative Anachronism.
Costumes.
A lot of drama involved usually. But it also involves this physical violence part where you're actually attacking people, sword fighting, you know, really getting in with the physicalness. And I think that's really important, especially for boys, that physicalness of it, of actually getting out there and acting it out.
I've heard that these games are more popular with boys in America, but that they're more popular with girls in Europe.
Yeah, well, that's true. And especially role-playing games tend to be more popular with girls in Europe. But you know, it kind of depends on the game. There are versions of LARP that are a bit more aggressive, and that tends to you don't see as many girls in those ones. But then you have the more role-playing ones. And I got into FANWAR because I saw it as a great avenue for helping kids to express that violence that they were taking in without it ending up exploding. I could see that kids really needed this kind of play. They really needed, you know, war play. But how to do it safely? How could they end up doing it in a way that was, you know, they could play it, but it didn't end up, nobody ended up getting hurt, and it was also really helping them to process it in a good way. And also, I could be involved, because as a teacher, you want to be involved. Part of what's so neat about it is that you help kids to see other solutions.
To problems.
Where if you take the laissez-faire approach, which is another approach, there's like, I'll either ban it, or maybe I'll just take the laissez-faire approach to violence. They can do whatever they want. Doesn't matter. I'll just turn my back. Well, but then what about safety? I mean, they start hurting each other, or they do things that are really violent and aggressive, and you don't have any clue. I mean, that's a really bad solution. So neither of them really work. That's why you have to be in there. So I got into FANWAR because I wanted kids to have an opportunity to express themselves and do these kind of arts and let out this aggression that was building up from the culture and allow them to express it in a way that didn't hurt anybody. And I do it as an after-school program for kids. They come and it's free. You know, they just come and play. And it's a way I kind of think of helping the community to solve its aggressiveness problem.
Right. And the scripts, a lot of them come from the politics of the day.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's sort of the underlying thing. I like kids to have big issues to deal with. There's a great study, it's eluding me right now who it's by, but That just talks about how a lot of kids who don't think they're really intelligent, that intelligence, they think intelligence is something that you have, like some sort of number or something, that you have intelligence or you don't, but that actually when children are treated as like they're intelligent, like they're treated like there's intelligent stuff that they should solve, amazingly, they become intelligent. Who would have thought, right? So I like to make sure that the what's being discussed when we do these adventures is current events. A lot of the stuff that's going on in this fantasy world that appears to be just fantasy is cloaked and as current events, things that are going on, genetic modification of plants, political climates in other countries, all that's being acted out in the fantasy world. And so kids are getting to then feel like they have a certain amount of control over the world, right, by being there.
And they're doing some critical thinking about
exactly.
the issues as
and
well.
And thinking about, I don't really like this whole slave labor thing. Now that I'm there, it really doesn't seem so good.
Right. And the immigration issues and all of that. I remember that one time when we went to the Ren Fair, we had recently done research on the burning times and how so many women were burned during the Renaissance at the stake, along with gay people. We celebrate this as some, great time, and that probably like 9 million women were burned during that time. And I remember we all dressed up and went as a protest to the Renaissance Fair.
Right, right.
Protesting these burning times. It was so great.
Yeah, and that's part of the tradition of it. It's part of the tradition of that, of FanWars, to do that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a music break now, and when we come back, I'm going to steer Chris into talking about how the arts can also be used to contain this aggression, and we'll also be taking your calls after our music break, and I'll announce the phone number when we come back on, but just so you know that the studio lines are 895-2448 or 800-499-7117. So we'll take a little music break here, and then we'll be back with Chris and take your calls. We'll talk about the arts and things. Here's some music. Here's some Tracy Grammer for you. Hey ho. It's sort of on the topic, I think. Here we go.
TV's on, the favorite son is watching how the West was won. Daddy, please, a plastic gun, get brother one for twice the fun. Little camo helmet heads, making brave and playing dead. And missiles made of gingerbread and dollars on the dime. A hey-ho, so it goes, a point of sale, the puppet show. The merchant kings of war and woe have turned their hands to labor. Sound out the trumpet noise, the cannons bark and jump for joy. Someone's dead and Diamond Boy has fallen on his saber. Another world across the sea, home for little busy bees, sweating in some factory. Hurry please, more of these. Action dolls with laser sights, robot planes that shoot at night. Faster kid and get it right, we're rolling down the light. Hey-oh, so it goes, a point of sale, the puppet show. The merchant kings of war and woe have turned their hands to labor. Sound out the trumpet noise, the cannons bark and jump for joy. Someone's dead and Island Boy has fallen on a saber.
Well, we're back. That was great. That was great, wasn't it, Chris?
Yeah, I really like Tracy Grammer, and I think the song is apropos. I mean, the song "Hey Ho" that Tracy Grammer is talking about war toys. And I really like to clarify when I have these discussions with people and parents, and I do these talks with parents, that some people think that I have an opinion of war toys, that kids should really be, you know, that war toys are a good thing, that kids should really, you know, buy war toys. The war toy industry is a very different issue than war play. The war toy industry has to do with big corporations trying to sell kids on war and trying to sell kids on the idea of war toys and the sort of limited idea of war play. And that's not at all a good approach. Children need to play. And when you give them a war toy, something specific, then it can be problematic.
Yes, well, this is KZYX and Education Now. We're talking here with Christopher Melville about violence, youth violence, and you're welcome to call in and ask Chris questions or myself at 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. And I wanted to go into, Christopher, the arts now as a container for this aggression. Especially it concerns me, this issue, and just how important I really feel it is, because that's what's being cut out of the curriculum.
We don't have arts in a lot of the schools anymore, which is really interesting as well. I mean, you see this upswing in violence, and you see a downswing in artistic expression.
Right.
And those, you think, well, you know, correlation is not causation. It doesn't necessarily mean one's related to the other, but there's definitely a connection. You know, you have examples of a lot of people who had violent pasts. They had violent upbringings. Like, you know, Robert Frost had this really violent and abusive father, but he didn't really become violent and abusive himself. He found this way to contain his violence, a way to express it, and he became a poet. Often, art is one of the best means of expressing violence and aggression and sort of channeling it into a positive outlet. So you take something that all this media that's being put into us about violence and all these feelings of the family that really a lot of families that are broken apart, a lot of aggressiveness and anger in the family, that brings up really intense emotions. So if you don't find a way to express those emotions,
right,
then suddenly you get really violent kids.
Right. So that dance, it can be a container.
Yeah.
Are drawing.
Drawing,
painting,
drama, painting.
Especially drama, yeah.
All these things, yes. Anything that allows you to express intense emotion.
Right.
Right, because that's what's sort of causing this, is you have these family issues. And while you can't necessarily solve the family issues yourself, the child has to have a sense of feeling like they have some kind of control. That's what Gerard Jones talks about in the Killing Monsters book, is that part of this fantasy play and our ability to express it helps us to feel like we have some sort of control over those feelings. So when you dance out this aggression, when you dance out this violent feelings that you have, you start to feel like I have some kind of control over that feeling.
Yes.
And you develop more a better ability to deal with it. And then if you are feeling really angry and then you go into a dance class and you can just really let all that anger out. You can
right.
dance really angry and be furious and then you just let it all out and then suddenly you feel really great,
right.
You know?
I think sports can work that way too.
They can, although of course then you have people who they take their aggressive to the max and they play sports really aggressively and
yes.
And I deal with that, you know, like in Fanwar, like I was saying before, I have people who come with a lot of aggression bottled up. And it's hard for them to learn where's the limit. What is enough force and what is too much force? And so that's something else that's great about. I think sports help you to figure that out, but also a live action role play LARP stuff does that too. And dance and drama does that as well. I mean, if you get involved in art when you're having the opportunity to express yourself, that's when you really have to examine yourself and go, well, where is the limit? What's too far?
And creative writing, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember that kids were allowed to write anything they wanted to write. It's not what you write down. It's what you do that's, you know, can be judged about your behavior. You should be able to say anything in writing and express yourself, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that saying, in fact, part of the problem that you would get with writing is kids that are feeling like they can't express. I mean, kids are really good at finding out what it is that you have a problem with as a teacher. you know, you have a problem with it, I'm going to find out what it is. And often, so then, you know, if you have a lot of taboos in areas that are not okay with you, that's the button that's going to get pushed. And if you just let kids express themselves, they get over whatever it is they're stuck on, and they move on. But when we put roadblocks in front of kids about their behavior, and we say, you can't write about that, or that's violent, you know, then they never get to deal with it. They never get to go, you know, I had this horrifying dream, and I need to write it down so that I can say that it's gone.
Yes.
And I can, like, crumple up the paper and burn it afterwards, and it just makes me feel so good.
Right. Especially if you don't have a good ear, someone that listens to you, being able to write it down or draw it or paint it or dance it out or sing, play an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are essential. They're not frills.
Right. Well, but this is another point that I'd like to bring up, which I think a lot of teachers, they hear teachers talk about this concept a lot. You know, you need to have arts. And a lot of teachers know they need to have arts. I mean, it's not like they think they don't. It's just they don't have time in their curriculum. You know, there's more and more arts are getting cut, and they're said, okay, you've got 3 hours to do English today. You have to do 3 hours of English, and you also have to do 3 hours of math. And then that leaves you, I think, 30 minutes for science, and I think that's about it. Mm-hmm. So where are you supposed to do all this art to help kids deal with this aggression? And, you know, it's kind of ironic, too, because most teachers would say, I mean, really, what's more important to them? I mean, really, are we're so concerned that kids know how to do this arithmetic, or are we concerned that kids are, like, really great human beings who care for each other? I mean, really, what's important?
What's important? And there is that, too, that arithmetic is not math.
Right.
That's another thing that's getting lost from children not being able to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because playing is how you develop, moving your big body, you know, your big muscles, your gross motor. That's where math is developed.
Yeah, and there's many benefits to arts beyond just expressing violence.
Right.
So I was going to say that you know, that a lot of teachers know they need to do this. How do they do it? Well, part of that is integrating your curriculum. I mean, if you can integrate the arts into what you're doing, so that your math lessons have an artistic aspect to it, so that your English lessons have this dance in them. If you get creative about the way that you are allowed to do those things, then you have more opportunities to let kids express their aggression, and still, you know, meet the needs of whatever of your school's expectations.
Right. I don't. Line one is ringing, but I don't. Usually, we don't pick up line one, so I'm not going to. And it's usually calls on another line. I'll give those numbers again at 895, 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. This is Education Now. We're talking about violence and the arts here with Christopher Melville tonight. You're welcome to call in. So let's go on, Christopher.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's possible in the way that's with the testing and everything, the way that it's structured today, if a teacher even wanted to bring the arts into the curriculum? Oh, someone is calling. Hold on 1 minute. We're going to bring you up. Hello, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Hi. I have a question for Christopher. You've mentioned Fan War, and I'm wondering if there's some place locally that he teaches or guides the class that's available.
For Fan War?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, there is. I'm mainly based in Ukiah right now, and I do Fan War in Ukiah. Through the normal school year, I do that every Wednesday after school. Starting around 4:30 at Logat Park.
We're getting a little bit of an echo. Do you have your radio on?
No.
Well, I don't know why we are, but just go, keep going.
Yeah. So I do that in Ukiah base, but in the summer I travel around a lot. I have a lot of interest in a lot of different places all around the North Bay. So currently I travel, like I go to the Narrabar River Redwoods next week. The week after that, I mean, I go to St. Helena. I'll be in Ukiah the week after that, and then I go to Berkeley. I mean, I have a lot of places that I do this, and I do it, you know, through the week, usually Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So, but locally, Ukiah is the place to find it. Yeah.
And how would we find out about it?
Well, you can go to www.fanwar.
Okay.
fanwar.com, F-A-N-W-A-R. There's a calendar there that you can go to, and it lists all the locations and where to go and how to contact me.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye.
Thanks for calling. All right.
So you were asking me about if you were a teacher, do you think it's possible to integrate that with what you're doing?
Yes.
I mean, I think it's really difficult. I mean, unless you have a really good administrator, a really good director of your school who understands this, it's really difficult to integrate this stuff. And so you have to be really creative with it. Now, and it's ironic because most teachers, you know, they know you need to do it, but they have so much resistance from the state or the way that they're supposed to do stuff that they can't. And so I think that if you're careful, or if you start to think about how can I integrate dance into my language lessons? I mean, what's the same about dance and English? What's the same about music and writing? How can I bring music into my writing lessons? And you start to think about how can I get kids, instead of just learning about writing mechanics, how can I get them just to write?
Right, that's the thing. Is just to write and not be so concerned about the grammar.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that might upset people, but really, if you can read it, then you're understanding it.
And we're just talking about goals. What is the goals as teachers? What are our goals? Is our goal that we have kids who have this great grammar? Or is our goal that we have really intelligent, wonderful people who care about each other and can write beautifully?
Yeah. Well, of course. I go for the second.
Yeah, well, me too. But I mean, I think sometimes it gets lost.
Yeah.
And I think that if you really work at as a teacher, you know, being as a really effective teacher, and you really make it wonderful, it's really hard for directors to complain about you, because you know you're really doing a wonderful job. I mean, I'm not saying it won't, but right. If you really do it well, it's harder.
And then if you're stuck with, I know that, for instance, if you're having to use textbooks and you can't go beyond those into the current things that are happening, or say, for instance, I always use the history, the people's history.
Mm-hmm.
People are always finding out different things in history and in science constantly. Things are changing constantly. So it seems to me that having this book that's, you know, a textbook that's, it's all practically outdated by the time you get it. And so I really like the idea of being more flexible and then using also that. Oh, someone else is calling. Hold on. We're going to take this call. Hello.
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 Who's that?
This is Athena. Did you want to talk to Christopher or to me?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I had a question. I heard you talking a little bit earlier about war toys. What was that? Exactly.
Okay, War Toys. I'm glad you brought that up again. I was talking about the song, Tracy Grammer's song, Hey Ho, and that War Toys, a lot of people make the association of War Toys as anything that you would use in war, like a gun or, like planes, stuff like that, stuff that's in war. Now, I don't advocate War Toys myself, like going and buying a small child a real pistol, like a real, you know, plastic pistol that the kid should have, because it's so limited. The child can only use it in one way. That's not really developmentally useful for the child, because they can only use it to do one thing. But if the child wants to create something that's of their own, like a stick or their finger, and they use it like a gun, that's creativity. So when you look for toys for kids, you're trying to look for toys that have multiple purposes. You know, if a child makes a gun out of Legos, that was their choice. But the Legos don't dictate that they should be a gun. You see that, and that's an important developmental difference.
Okay, because I mean, you said war toys, and I'm just picturing a G.I. Joe doll type thing. And
well, I was really into G.I. Joes as a kid.
I mean, so was I, and apparently we're good people, and that would be considered a war toy.
Well,
it
would to a certain degree, but I guess part of the thing about the G.I. Joes is that they're action figures. My G.I. Joes did all kinds of things that weren't just violent.
Yes, they did.
They were dolls for boys. I mean, that's what was so cool. And, you know, you could do all this stuff, and they would climb, and they would swing down, and they did things. So you're looking at it, and you're going, you know, what is the potential for play here. Is all that this does just violent killing? Or is there potential for the child to work out the violence?
Yeah, but you know, Cobra Commander was a bad guy, but look how rich he turned out. I mean, you know, when you look at him in that light, he really wasn't all that bad.
Yeah, well, you know, as G.I. Joe person myself, you know, we always broke the rules, you know.
Just a second, Cobra Commander.
Totally.
Yeah. Anything else? Hello? Oh, I guess our caller's gone, mm-hmm. Chris. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we run out of time now, this has been really fun for me, but I wanted to tell the audience about Alliance for Childhood, the AllianceForChildhood.org. And last time I talked to you, I told you how they were very concerned about kindergarten rage. And I want to read you, we believe that one cause of kindergarten rage is unrealistic expectations for academic performance by young children, and we're working to moderate that. But we can't do away with every source of stress and anxiety in children's lives. We can, however, build up their own inner capacities for resilience and coping with stress by letting them play. The Alliance continues to promote open-ended play outside of school through conferences, meetings, workshops, and play sessions with children. Our playwork projects takes us into parks, departments, zoos, children's museums, and other places where children love to play. We are finding increasing interest in this work everywhere we go. In January, Penny Wilson, a longtime play worker for London's Adventure Playgrounds, returned to the U.S. as part of the Alliance's play project. We recognized enormously successful play sessions in a low-income neighborhood of Flint, Michigan. Isn't that where Michael Moore made his first movie? These were filmed for the upcoming PBS documentary, Where Do the Children Play? The Alliance and the Child Development Institute at Sarah Lawrence College co-sponsored a workshop with Penny on adventuresome play. It was standing room only. We also met with the designers of the new Imagination Playground in New York City to talk about the role of playworks there, and with the staff of the National Children's Museum in Washington, whose new building will have large areas for open-ended play. This fall, the documentary film, Where Do the Children Play?, will be shown on PBS stations. It was conceived by Alliance board member Elizabeth Goodenough, lecturer in humanities at the University of Michigan, who has also edited an upcoming book with the same title. We are promoting the film and book and will use its release as an opportunity to work with those advocating for play in many communities. So that's news from the Alliance for Childhood there. Well, I know you agree with that, Christopher.
Absolutely.
We used to have adventure playgrounds and I remember Aquarius Park, and it had these beautiful dragons and slides and seahorses, and just wonderful. It makes me very sad that children aren't being allowed to play.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of why people get stuck in dilemmas, like the idea that you need to ban violent play or you need to just laissez-faire, because they're not thinking of how do we allow children to figure these things out, and how do we allow them to be able to express it in a way that allows them to be creative.
We have another caller, Christopher. Hold on. Hello, are you there?
Yes, thank you so much for the show this evening. I'm wondering if you could give any insight into the horrendous violence that sometimes occurs in schools, and so much of it seems to be in small towns as opposed to urban areas, and if you have any insights about that. And also, at what point or how does the teacher negotiate disturbed writing as opposed to distinguishing it from just a child's working out the writing, as opposed to like something that could be a precursor to, you know, serious violent outbursts, you know, using weapons and that sort of thing? And I'll take my answer on the air.
Thank you. Well, those are really great questions and really big ones. I don't know that I can offer really, you know, really concrete answers on those. They're really big. But it's been interesting to me. I worked in a small town for a while, in St. Helena, which was, and there were some violent actions of that kind. I mean, not anything to that scale, but yeah, you know, there's violence, and you look at these small towns, and what is it about small towns that creates this kind of violence? I think that one of the things that you might look at there is oppressiveness. Usually in a cosmopolitan, you know, big city, you have a lot of opportunities for expression, and a lot of opportunities for kids to go to dances, kids to go to do drama, to get involved in extracurricular activities where they can express themselves. But in small towns, sometimes you will get situations where kids start to feel trapped because it's very cliquish. You get a certain group of kids who feel like they can dominate the school because it's small, and the other kids who feel trapped by that. And they don't have the outlets. A lot of times they don't have the outlets that they would have somewhere else.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, are we going to call Ukiah a small town?
I don't know. I mean, that's
you know,
a tough one.
The high school in Ukiah,
it's huge.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. Like the violence that we saw at the university here a while back, mm-hmm. you know, 32 people. That is huge, huge university. And granted, you should be able to, by your time you're that age, to deal with that many people. But I bet, I think that kids are not in small, like my high school, there were 600 kids. No, not 2,500. Not, you know, and it, you didn't have that feeling that you were being watched by police, you know, or guards or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that my mentor Joy Turner really felt that these large institutions, especially high schools, were alienating. And you thought that the kids that looked like they were popular were having fun, but they weren't. They were also feeling alienated. And so I really think that they're too big too soon.
Mm-hmm.
That it becomes less personal too soon. And about the writing, how can you distinguish if the writing
that's a difficult one
is telling you that something is going on? Well, I think that once you read it, then if it's possible to get into conversation.
Absolutely, that's what I was going to say too. That you have to have good rapport with your students.
Right.
I mean, that's part of what you have to develop as a teacher is a relationship with your students that they trust you.
Right.
And if they do, then you can talk to that student about what they're writing about.
And if you've got 100 or 200 kids in an English class,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
How are you supposed to talk to that really disturbed,
right. How are you?
About that really disturbed writing
right.
and really help that child to process it? But this is another thing I think that teachers often miss.
But the oppression is I think you're right.
Well,
too.
There is the oppression of the small town, but something that teachers often miss is the concept around when you have somebody who's really this is really disturbed writing and you're writing it is that we think that we have these concepts we're trying to teach, but we never tell the kids that we're trying to teach these concepts. I mean, we don't actually say to the kids, you know what, this writing is really good for helping you, you know, deal with this aggression. That's why I'm hoping that people are going to write this stuff, and so that's why we're doing this. I mean, if you're really open about what you're doing,
then they might be more responsive.
They might be, and then when you talk to them about it, it's not like you're trying to, like, you know.
Right.
Covertly do something.
Well, I know that I had students who came to me when I was, you know, private school because and they want to know, can I draw a marijuana leaf?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you can draw anything you want. They were flabbergasted. They were
That they would have freedom of expression.
They would be free to draw a marijuana leaf, you know, or to write a four-letter word on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But anyway, well, the time is fast going, and it's really, really fun. But first of all, Chris, let's be sure we give that contact information. Fanwar, www.fanwar.com. And do you want to give any other contact information?
Oh, yeah, people can email me about that if they want to. It's Christopher Puma.
CHRISTOPHERPUMA at fanwar.com.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay. Christopher Puma at fanwar.com. And of course, my contact information is Hermes, H-E-R-M-E-S, at pacific.net. Or you can check me out on the web at www.pacificsites, pacificsites.com/Hermes. And you also can always send Mary at marykzyx.org feedback about this show. We love to hear it. Now, I also, next month, I'm hoping to have someone who's going from Waldorf, who's going to talk to us about Waldorf and dance, and I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also looking forward to sharing with you as the months progress work from a conference which is going to be this fall, October 12th through the 14th in Irvine, California, called Shared Visions, and celebrating innovation and inspiration. And I'm probably going to be going to that, and I'll be bringing you some wonderful stuff back from that AMS workshop as well. Now, I wanted to tell you some other things here before we get going. Here we are. I think I've got, here we are. The Toastmasters Club offers a proven way to improve your communication skills, deliver great presentations, and be a better listener. Phone 707-263-5350 and ask for Greg Scott. That's 263-5350 to get involved in learning to become a better speaker. And I'm offering two empowerment workshops through the city of Ukiah. One is a parent-child growth workshop. The other is a parent empowerment. Interested parties must pre-register with the city of Ukiah at 411 West Clay Street in Ukiah. If you want more information on that, you can contact me at hermes@pacific.net. So that's two workshops. They're going to be six-week workshops, limited to six people, maximum eight, and they'll run from Monday the 25th of June to Monday the 30th of July. Then I wanted to, there's a summer program at Tree of Life Montessori Charter School in Ukiah. They'll be having an integrated curriculum including music, sports, art, drama, core subjects, and environmental education, guided with Montessori materials and credentialed teachers. For more information, you can call 462-0913. That's 462-0913. They're four-week sessions, and they're starting up on the 25th, and you can do 1 week or more weeks if you'd like to. So that's Tree of Life Montessori Charter School Summer Program, 462-0913. Now, also I wanted you to know, I wanted to tell you that tomorrow on Hot Flash, Friday here on KZYX at 9 a.m., the Friday morning Hot Flash show, the topic is planning and development in the Ukiah Valley. Join host Karen Ottoboni and Judy Pruden, chair of the Ukiah Planning Commission, to learn more about plans for the old Masonite plant property and surrounding areas. And Forthright Friday is also tomorrow at 1 with Joy LeClaire. She's interviewing Loretta Alper, writer, director, and producer of the soon-to-be-released movie War Made Easy, narrated by Sean Penn. They'll be discussing the work of the Media Education Foundation and how war is sold to the American consumer. That's tomorrow at 1 with Joy LeClaire. Now it's time for us to go. It's actually way past time to go. Stay tuned for those reality guys. They're going to be giving you a great show tonight, all night, with Dead Air, and then on with Verge. It's going to be wonderful old-timey music. So this is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willetson, Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. Listener-supported community public broadcasting. Thank you for listening, and here is Earth and Sky.
Earth and Sky.
Thursday, June 21st. Today is the June solstice, when the Earth's north pole tilts most toward the sun for this year.
And the Earth's south pole tilts most away. By tradition, the June solstice marks the first day of summer in the northern hemisphere and the first day of winter in the